You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tyre Nichols will be remembered for the life he lived today. The 29-year-old called Sacramento home before moving to Tennessee, known as a free spirit who loved photography and a passion for skateboarding. Loved ones gathered at Regency Community Skate Park in North Natomas earlier this week, which was his home turf, and another memorial in Sacramento is scheduled this weekend. But today, the father of a 4-year-old son will be laid to rest. A funeral in Memphis is scheduled to take place in about 30 minutes. A funeral that is also tied to activism and police brutality. The video of Tyre's violent beating by Memphis police last month following a traffic stop is now part of a chronicle of videos in recent years taken either from police body cameras or from bystanders with cell phones that show a deadly encounter with law enforcement. Multiple officers have since been charged with second-degree murder. Others have been relieved of duty, and emergency responders who arrived on scene have been fired. But once again, the culture, the practices, and the policies of law enforcement are being called into question. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Keon Gilbert, an associate professor of public health and social justice at St. Louis University College and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. But joining us first is former Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn, who is now the dean of the Public Safety Center at American River College. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with something that I personally grappled with. I talked about it with people who are journalists and also outside of journalism. And that's the video of Tyre Nichols being brutally beaten by Memphis police, and he died in a hospital 3 days later. Did you watch the video, and do you think it's important for the public to watch the video?
Yes, I did watch the video. And I think in terms of the public watching the video, I think at some point we will kind of moderate what we have now come to be as normal as watching these videos. If you've seen that video, it's brutal. And I don't know that everybody wants to or needs to see that. As we heard the mother say, she hasn't watched it. And I often think if something happened like that to one of my daughters, would I be able to watch it? And I don't think I would be able to. So obviously the family should have the opportunity to see it. And I do think in some cases, the family should be part of that decision-making process if it goes wider to the general public. But I'm sure as time goes on, we'll kind of wade through those waters.
Yeah. When having this conversation with another journalist, I mean, there's an important point that this video, now that he has since deceased, this video is also his voice about what happened and what unfolded. As someone with nearly 4 decades in law enforcement, you also educate about the racist and discriminatory practices that shape inequity in our community. You have a lived experience as a Black man who dedicated a very significant portion of your life to law enforcement. How does that shape your understanding of what unfolded?
Well, I think our experiences shape all of our understanding. So my understanding is growing up in Oak Park and witnessing violence, living in this world as a Black man, and then spending, you made it sound so long, 4 decades in law enforcement, and the things that come along with being a Black man in that environment. So, yeah, I think every single one of us, our belief system is heavily shaped by our experiences, and I wouldn't change my experiences for anything. I think growing up in Oak Park and being raised by my mom is the core of all my decisions, everything I've done throughout my entire life, both in work and personal.
Did it surprise you that these police officers that are now charged with second-degree murder beat him, even though they knew it was being recorded on their body cameras?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think... Now that we've had body cameras for a while, and I think a lot of them were not wearing body cameras, by the way, so I think that's part of what needs to be looked at in Memphis for the specialty units. But I think they just become part of your uniform. So people eventually go back to being who they are. And clearly something about these 5, and quite frankly, more than just the 5 that have been arrested, had, I don't know if you want to call it defects, but character, serious character issues and morale issues to be able to just brutally beat another human being like that.
If there weren't body cameras, our understanding of what happened very well could have been completely different. I mean, we would have relied heavily on the officers' accounts of what happened, which contradicted the videos when we saw what happened. Now, these videos of deadly encounters, I mean, this has really risen in recent years, from cell phone videos to body camera videos. What goes into corroborating and checking whether an officer's account is truthful?
Well, the body cameras help with that significantly. There's not too many things better than actually being able to view it for yourself. And that's also the benefit of releasing videos, certain videos, to the public. So the public can view, be as close to being there as possible and be able to come to their own conclusions of how they feel about it. But it's the same inside a police department. There's been many cases just around the country and even here in Sacramento where the body cameras were what enabled us to prove what actually happened. And unfortunately, in some cases, it wasn't what the officer said happened.
Yeah. You and I have had this conversation when it comes to police recruitment. I've had these with multiple other chiefs as well. Recruitment has been a challenge for many departments in recent years. Now, that's also coupled with a push for diversity in law enforcement as well, so that a department reflects the community that it serves. But the five officers charged in Tyree Nichols' death are all Black. Are we looking at the benefit of having a diverse police department in the wrong way?
Yeah, I think we talk about this in the wrong way a lot. First of all, I think when it comes to these issues and other law enforcement related issues, we solely focus on law enforcement when the issue is much larger than just law enforcement. And so we're going to fall woefully short every time we solely say this is a law enforcement issue and therefore there's law enforcement solutions. Law enforcement has issues, no doubt about it, but this is a societal issue. We ask officers when crime goes up, we ask the police department every single time, go out there, crack down, get this crime down. And so we put people in those situations. And then we say, let's diversify our police departments. And a lot of times the way it feels to me is like diversify for diversity's sake.
Like checking a box.
Like checking a box. And just because you're Black doesn't mean you'll be a good police officer. And the other thing that we need to realize is, and what is why I did all the research and teach the classes that I teach, is because we have to realize we race and bias are a part of this country, and it's a big part of this country. And everybody in this country has some of the same similar biases because we grew up in the same society. We're watching the same TV shows. We're seeing the same advertisement. We're hearing the same conversations. So, you know, if we solely focus on it's white officers versus Black individuals, and it's based on race and bias, and so therefore we don't think a Black person can do that. Black people have the same biases. Now, because as Black people we grew up in the Black community, oftentimes we see contradictory information to those biases. So our biases might be a little less, but we still have all those same biases. So if you are somebody that thinks that these things are solely happening because of race issues and bias, just hiring Black officers doesn't mean that's going to be solved. Now, I personally believe it's due to multiple of things, not just any one thing. But diversifying a police department is really to have diverse experiences in your police department. And just because you're Black doesn't mean you'll be a good police officer.
Yeah. And another issue are traffic stops. I mean, this isn't the first time that a traffic stop with someone who is unarmed, a person of color, has been killed by police officers. And traffic stops are also a source of revenue for police departments and for the city and the counties. Now, is the incentive for traffic stops, does it run the risk of being abused? And what improvements, if any, do you think should be made?
Well, anytime you have power and authority, there's a risk of abuse in any profession, not just law enforcement. So that's why you have supervision. That's why you have these checks and balances to try to ensure that those things doesn't happen. I would push back a little bit on traffic stops are a source of revenue mm-hmm. for a police department because they are not. The police department doesn't get hardly any money from traffic stops. I could not tell you what the exact dollar amount because it's so minor. Traffic stops, you know, historically, you know, some departments, you know, you might want to call it quotas or performance measures. It's a measure of how somebody stays active during their shift. Now, I think it's a very poor measure because it goes away from a mission of a police department if all you're focused on is the number of stops as opposed to the impact that you have on the community safety. So there's a lot of discussion about traffic stops. Many cities, San Francisco, Seattle, LA, are starting to put restrictions on their respective police departments at a city level to not be able to stop certain traffic violations that are minor, expired registration, broken taillights. Now, I think that the intent behind that and the reason behind that is faulty. Most of what I hear is because there's bias in the police department, and so therefore their racism or their bias is being played out in traffic stops. Well, I'll tell you, just restricting their ability to do minor traffic stops does absolutely nothing to bias. It doesn't address it at all. There's no training, there's no experiential learning, there's none of that. And so that's one. And two, if I really am racist or if I really am biased and my intent is to stop a certain segment of drivers, I'll find a different reason. I don't need that reason. So I think, yeah, it might provide a little bit of relief, but if that's really the intent behind those, it's falling woefully short because, again, we're not looking at it holistically. And how do we address the root? And so if the root is bias, tell me how we are addressing that.
You and I have had these conversations over the last 5 years with the shooting death of Stephon Clark, the murder of George Floyd, and now we're talking about Tyre Nichols. How has media coverage changed in your view, or has it?
Well, I think there's bias in media coverage, too. If you think about—
And does it differ between local and national outlets as well?
Well, I think some of the national, you know, cable news are maybe a little bit more biased, not necessarily race always, but just towards their agenda. I think maybe the local news is a little bit closer to the community, so maybe that's a little less. But, I mean, if you just look at what's covered and how it's covered, there's bias in the news just like we should expect there is. There's bias in our entire society. There's no any corner of our society that is absent bias. And so if you think about, like, just take shootings in Sacramento. The shooting on K Street Mall or the shooting 2 summers ago in Old Sacramento— how much were those covered? How much did our political leaders respond to those? How much did they tweet and march and protest and have press conferences? Yet every month there's way more people killed in places like Del Paso Heights than were killed that day on K Street Mall, and you don't hear anything from pretty much anybody. And it's a constant in some of our communities that people are losing their lives. And if I was to watch the media and watch the reaction of some of our leaders, I would come to the conclusion that those neighborhoods don't matter because we don't hear about those things in those neighborhoods. It's like they never happened.
Hmm. Given that March will mark 5 years since the shooting death of Stephon Clark by Sacramento police, and you were the chief at that time, how has his death shaped you as a chief and also outside of your role in law enforcement as a person?
Well, I think that incident, unfortunately, in our country and probably around the world, a lot of tragedy is what kind of changes us and hopefully moves us forward. So I always look at tragedies as if we don't learn something, if we don't progress from it, then it stays just a tragedy as opposed to a tragedy and something that changed things. And I think that incident definitely changed not only our city and our police department, but around the world. These videos that we see now, like in Memphis, released within a couple of weeks, that was unheard of before Stephon Clark. We released that quickly, and now it's become kind of the norm, but that was the start of that. How we deal, at least in Sacramento, how we interact with families on the other side of that tragedy, I think was greatly changed by the Stephon Clark incident. And I think that's a good thing. If you think about the mother of Tyre Nichols praised the way the chief of police in Memphis handled the aftermath. And I think that has been a huge change. I think 5-10 years ago, we might have ignored that family with the tragedy that they were going through. So I think there's a lot of changes. I think body cameras help. But we have to understand that no one thing is going to curtail this, stop this. And if you look at those videos in Memphis, I didn't see one supervisor anywhere in every minute of those videos. And you have a specialty unit that's charged with addressing violent crime, that's clearly aggressive, that is going out in unmarked cars, and is not responsible to the radio and to handling calls. And to think that that unit didn't have a supervisor working with them to ensure that they don't step over the line. And I might add, if anybody watches that video, as egregious and brutal and hard to watch as that was, that thinks that there's a high likelihood that that's the first time that they ever cross the line with their force that they used on somebody, I would say they're living in a different world. And so that department better be looking at their past contacts, better be looking at body cameras and calls for service to see if they in the past had done excessive force to somebody else, because I would say the likelihood is high.
Yeah. Why did you want to become a police officer?
I didn't. I accidentally became a police officer. I wish I could say it was because I wanted to save the world and do great things in the community, but they paid $5 an hour more than I was making at Florin Mall. So my whole intention was to quit the police department after I graduated from Sac State. And after about 8 years, I started working as a neighborhood police officer in Strawberry Manor and teaching at Grand High School. And I decided I could do the community involvement and community engagement that I love to do as a police officer. But I never knew that was possible growing up, because all I saw, you know, I was arrested at 16, and all I saw in my neighborhood was black and white squad cars driving around and either issuing tickets or arresting people and not stopping on the corner talking to us kids or anything like that. So I had no idea police officers could do those kind of jobs that I've done as a police officer.
Did you face discrimination, even racism, within the department over your time, and also even maybe some pushback in your own hometown of Oak Park for being an officer?
My core group of friends that I grew up with since like 6 years old are still my core group of friends. And absent, you know, probably major criminal activity, it wouldn't have mattered what I chose as a profession. They'd still be my friends. And that's why they're my closest friends as family. But I don't think there's too many people in this world in certain segments of our society that didn't face discrimination in every facet of their life. In my personal life and the police department, I remember at one point I was on the sergeant's list, and a friend of mine was also on the sergeant's list who's African-American, and somebody really high up in the police department said, "We can't promote two blacks at the same time." And this was in my career. And so we still both got promoted. But there's that feeling, and every time I got promoted, I was told it was solely because I was black is the reason I got promoted, which is interesting because I was the only black captain. I thought there would be more black captains if all it took was to be black. There's ignorant people everywhere you go, no matter what you do, and you still have to persevere through that, do the right thing. And I always tell young kids, if you don't like the way your organization operates or some of the things it does, be successful and get into a position where you call the shots. And so ultimately, that's what I did. I became the first African-American police officer and police chief in Roseville and the first African-American police chief here. So now it was on me. If I didn't like something, then I could change it.
Well, tell us about your new role at American River College.
So I'm the dean over the Public Safety Center at American River College, which is all the administration of justice classes. There's a police academy, a fire academy, a lot of classes for parole, probation, all sorts of things related to public safety.
Going back to our conversation, the reason why you're here, you're talking about things that are so nuanced and it's a community issue from what I'm getting from you. What is the biggest improvement we as a community can make to prevent deaths like Tyre Nichols from happening?
I think the core of everything we do is we have to know the truth. We have to know the truth of how we got to the current environment that we're in. And I can tell you, I would say 90%+ of us do not. So I teach, I call it a way forward, where I teach history of how we got here. And we're in this state of California where we've been led to believe and we've been taught in schools that we're different than a lot of the other country. Specifically, we're different than the South, right? We are kind of like this utopia for the United States. This is what we want to be. But the reality is pretty much everything the South did, we did too in California. We had slavery. Right here in Sacramento, we had slavery. We had discrimination. And when we talk about urban renewal, that's, you know, the roots in housing discrimination, redlining, some of that started right here in Sacramento in terms of tax increment financing and how we tore down the minority neighborhoods and forced minorities into certain neighborhoods that were impoverished, that have lack of opportunities and all those things. And we are still suffering from that today. Del Paso Heights used to be a healthy, thriving, right. Middle class, upper middle class community. Oak Park, I grew up in Oak Park my entire youth. Went to school in Oak Park my entire youth, and I was never taught the history of Oak Park, that it was, didn't always, it wasn't always an impoverished community. It was the first suburb of Sacramento. It had an amusement park in the park. Well, I never knew that. I always thought Oak Park was the way it was when I lived there. And so I think the first thing we have to do is understand how we got here. Because if you're going to fix something, like if you go to the doctor and you have an ailment, that doctor's asking you all sorts of questions. The history, your parents' history, you know, how do you eat? What do you do? Because they're trying to get to the root of what's causing your ailments. And when it comes to these issues, we don't try to do that. We don't have no interest in doing that. We just come up with solutions that I'm thinking, because I've researched the history, I'm like, we've tried that before. Mm-hmm. We've tried that before. That doesn't hit to the root of the issue. And so we're going to keep going in the cycle. And then we get away with it by saying that we're in unprecedented times. We are not in unprecedented times.
Finally, do you see your role evolving into perhaps elected office? I mean, you have been a police chief, you're a Sacramento native, you're raised in Oak Park, you have a career serving the community as an officer, you're now educating students at American River College. I mean, do you see this evolving into perhaps a local office role, maybe mayor in 2024? Is that attractive to you?
I can guarantee you it won't be mayor in 2024. I'm still detoxing from politics. But I will say this, I would not ever rule anything out. If I feel like there's a right opportunity in some sort of elected office at whatever level that my experiences and whatever skills I bring to the table can help move us forward in a real manner instead of just to make people feel comfortable for a little bit, then I would at least consider it. But none of those opportunities have come up as of yet.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. That is former Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn, who is now the Dean of the Public Safety Center at American River College. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. If you're just joining us, I was talking with former Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn about Tyre Nichols and the culture, practices, and policy of law enforcement. We're going to continue this conversation with Keon Gilbert, an associate professor at the St. Louis University College for Public Health and Social Justice and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Good morning, Keon.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Vicki.
You know, with your lens of research shaping policies, how should we think about the deadly police encounter of Tyre Nichols with Memphis police?
So I think there's a few things to think about that the case with Tyre Nichols helps us to understand. One, it sort of further documents, you know, what happens when bad policing occurs and sort of the systemic issues that we've been discussing for quite a while that exist in police culture, police dynamics, the ways that police officers interact with communities, and even as the previous guest noted, sort of the multiple layers of failure that occurred in this particular case where there was very a lack of supervision, a number of people standing by and just watching these officers enact this vicious attack against him. And so this bystander effect or this sort of groupthink, you know, mentality where no one was intervening to help. So there's a lot to unpack with this particular case. Also, even the issues related to race, the race of the officers and the race of the victim.
You co-wrote a paper on how neighborhoods matter in fatal interactions between police and men of color. And in your abstract of the paper that you co-wrote, you lead with death by legal intervention is a health outcome disproportionately experienced by boys and men of color. This was published in 2018. What has changed since it published and what is still relevant today?
Yeah, so one of the things that we try to think about in that particular article and some other work that I've published is, so black men and men of color are 2 to 3 times, and in some cases even more, likely to be victims of police, police brutality, police violence, injury, and death. And what happens is when we sort of start to unpack some factors that contribute to that, we wanted to really sort of think about sort of what are a couple of contextual factors? What are things that may be contributing to these things? And so I think the Memphis case helps us to understand a few of these things. And so this particular specialized unit was deployed largely to high crime areas, and these areas also being highly concentrated with lower income individuals, lower income residents, and more highly concentrated to be Black. This happens across the country where there's a targeting of these types of resources in predominantly Black and predominantly lower income neighborhoods. And the thought is that these neighborhoods and communities are high in crime as a result of people either having being unemployed or underemployed in a number of ways, but these are also communities that have been systematically disinvested in. What the challenge is that we've deployed these resources in terms of policing these number of relationships and these factors, but we've not really systematically reinvested in these neighborhoods to ensure that people have access to high quality jobs, high quality schools. And so we're not addressing the root causes. We're only sort of addressing these sort of superficial things or outcomes as it relates to these neighborhood factors and characteristics.
So the intention of like hotspot policing falls short and isn't effective because that's not the right solution that should be applied. It's more of a Band-Aid solution to a deeper rooted problem.
Absolutely. It's a really sort of superficial fix to some of these issues where we recognize that addressing poverty or fixing schools are much harder things to do. But in fact, they are the right things to do in the better investment in communities across the country, whether that's at when we think about local policy, county, and even state and federal policies. And so we really fail neighborhoods and communities when we only think about policing people. And also we don't recognize that there are spillover effects that result from, you know, hyper policing in these neighborhoods where people experience high levels of community trauma. There's increases in both mental and physical health as a result of these activities when policing is both sort of very vicious and brutal in these examples.
You touched upon race. Given that the officers charged are Black officers and other officers of color have been involved in deadly police encounters that have been called into question, especially in recent years, now that we have body camera footage and cell phone footage, what role do you believe diversity has in law enforcement?
It's a great question. And so, you know, when you live in Black neighborhoods and Black communities and either other communities of color, those residents will tell you that it's not just white officers or non-Black officers that are involved in police brutality, police violence. And so the you know, having body cameras helps to document this a little bit and corroborate and verify community residents' claims and complaints before. And so this is helpful in a couple of different ways with recognizing that increasing the diversity of police agencies doesn't necessarily decrease police violence. And your previous guest also talked about this. And our work in a couple of different places also further documents that the increase of diversity sometimes leads to increasing the odds that especially men of color will experience police violence. And part of that is sort of really thinking about what are the systemic issues related to police culture, the ways that police officers are trained, and also recognizing that we really haven't empowered police officers who may represent or reflect certain demographic characteristics of particular neighborhoods to really be able to intervene in very important ways in these types of incidents. And so the idea of having a quote unquote diverse representation of police officers doesn't necessarily always translate into the type of community policing or the improvement in better relationships that we hope to see. And I think this example helps to document and show that. And it goes back to some of the other issues I mentioned before, in terms of thinking about what are the roles of police in particular neighborhoods that are highly concentrated Black and lower income.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about are generational issues. I mean, I think about Rodney King in 1991. That was more than 30 years ago. And although there are key differences in what happened, the outcome does involve brutal, excessive force of an unarmed Black man and multiple officers against one. And you're with your lens as well, as a researcher, a professor, wanting to shape policy, what is the biggest thing we can do to prevent things like this from happening again?
Yeah, so we really need to rethink the role of police officers in public safety and sort of what's the that continuum of public safety. You know, I think this case also highlights not only a number of failures, but a number of other entities and agencies that failed Tyre Nichols. You have not only the police, but you also have emergency response individuals at the same place and no one intervening and helping. Memphis is a great example, as well as other places where they have started to implement other training that helps people, helps officers to understand different types of intoxication, whether it's alcohol or whether it's from marijuana. And also they have a number of task force that help to intervene when there is sort of very clear someone having a mental health episode. And so we've implemented some of these in different places across the country, and it's not been sort of unilateral, universal. So that helps in some ways in terms of reducing police interactions in some of those cases, or pairing police officers with mental health professionals, social workers, et cetera, so that they respond to those particular cases. That's an example. The other types of things that, of course, people automatically focus on are police training. And in some of the work of some of my colleagues at Brookings, in particular, Rayshon Ray, who's at Brookings and the University of Maryland, his work has shown that bias exists in officers sort of writ large across the board, and the ways that they respond in particular to people who are Black, whether that's at traffic stops or other types of police encounters, that bias comes into play and they behave in very similar ways, as we've seen in the case of Tyre Nichols. And so training is not enough. We really sort of have to dig deeper into the role of public safety, the behaviors of police officers, and also some of the reforms that have happened in the past mm-hmm. have sort of structured or focused on why police sort of interact with individuals. And so your previous guest talked about he talked about traffic fines or traffic stops as a source of revenue. Well, there's been some evidence right. that shows.
And Keon, we have to leave it at that. We are wrapping up. Okay. This is just the tip of the iceberg, a very important conversation. Keon Gilbert is an associate professor with St. Louis University College for Public Health and Social Justice. He's also a fellow at the Brookings Institution. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day.